welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Today, we are bringing you a very special episode, as I like to call them. We are going to have a food theme because my co-host, well, Burl is doing some other work, is Keith Pandolfi, the Inquirer's food writer. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be filling in while Burl's away.
The podcast can be a lot of work, so I do have to press people into help every once in a while. So I really appreciate it. But since you're here, we are really going to, you know, do food, a food theme today. Our special guest is David Jackman, who is the owner and chef at Wild Weed, and has really just had a lot of acclaim in the last few months, really since he opened in July of 2024 or before.
Yeah, he was named one of the top 35 restaurants, new restaurants in America by Esquire magazine. And last week, he received a James Beard nomination as a semifinalist for Best Chef Great Lakes Region, which is a very big deal.
Yes. And so we're excited. We're going to talk to him about Wild Weed and his origin story. And it's always fun to talk about food.
Yes. Agreed.
But we'll start out with that because Keith is really the local expert on all things restaurant. We know that you all read about them and we like to see what's going on with our restaurant scene. So no one knows it better than Keith. So instead of talking about some political story, we could do that any week. We're going to talk about the restaurant industry. And I thought we would a little bit focus on openings and closings, which is a feature you do every month.
Yeah. As a lot of you might know or may have heard, there's been a lot of high-profile restaurant closings during the past couple months. It's deeply concerning for me and a lot of other people.
I mean, Red Feather and Oakley, Cactus Pear in Clifton, China Gourmet, Hyde Park. I mean, these are like shocking things.
Yes.
So you do get a lot of attentions, but your feature is openings and closings.
Yeah. And the good news is, as I was going through the restaurants that opened up in January, there's quite a few of them, and they're promising. I haven't been to all of them, but they are pretty big deals. So while we did have some closings, including China Gourmet, we also have some really exciting restaurants that are opening up. One of the ones I'm most excited about is a place called The Wayfarer over in Dayton, Kentucky. It is a pizza place, but much more than that. They have oysters. They have all these great appetizers. They have salads. And it's a large dining room. It's on the main drag there in Dayton. I can't remember the street. Yeah. But it's, if you know where Tuba Baking is, it's right around there. I've been once just for drinks. I've not been there. They didn't have the full menu going. But the pizza that they're serving is a mix between a East Coast style and a Detroit style, meaning that they're caramelizing. They're putting that cheese on the side and letting it caramelize. And then it is sliced like a Midwestern tavern style pizza into squares, which anybody who's been to La Rosa's knows that that's kind of a pretty Cincinnati thing.
Yep. Yep.
another really exciting place is called Flamingo Drive. It's being opened by the Barocco brothers who own the Governor in Milford. This is a Miami themed restaurant that is right next door to the Governor. The Barroccos grew up in Miami or spent a lot of time in Miami, and this is kind of their homage to their time there.
What does a Miami restaurant mean? You know what I think about when I think about a Miami restaurant?
Pink and teal.
Well, definitely, but Beluga. So Beluga was in Hyde Park, but like it just had like Miami vibes to it, or is it more like, is it the vibes or is it the food?
This is what I know. Again, okay. I haven't been there yet. It has a very extensive cocktail list with a lot of rum-based cocktails, as well as tequila, mezcal. There are empanadas on the menu. There's a Cubano on the menu. There's a chorizo burger on the menu. It sounds
Miami food.
Yeah, is that Miami food? I've honestly not spent much time in Miami, but
I love Miami. You know, and I lived in Florida for a while, not there, I love Miami. Yeah,
so we'll let Sherry review that one. I'll take you with me. When I go,
we'll do that. They want to hear from you, not me.
Well, you've dined with me a few times.
I have. It's very fun, you guys.
Excellent feedback. Also, we have Penny Flower, which is a new downtown restaurant that is open. It's in one of the former Holiday Inn downtown.
Oh, no, I don't know which one this is.
It's a former chef from Boca. I have had lunch there. I had a chicken schnitzel sandwich. It was very good. So I look forward to going back there. And then over in Covington, we have the West 6 Brewery out of Lexington is opening up or Covington House, which was, I think Covington House was around for a while. The building was recently an axe-throwing place, but okay. West 6 Brewing has come in and reopened it.
Well, that's a good place for a brewery. I could see that, and I was surprised the axe-throwing place was like something to do. I'm surprised it closed.
Covington is really exciting right now. We just had Carmelo, a new Italian restaurant, opened up there in November. I went there, and you'll be able to read my review of it.
Oh, this is a good part.
Tomorrow morning, so you can look forward to that. It's a very exciting new restaurant. It's got a lot of energy, a really good vibe. So there's another one to check out. And then there's a new butcher shop right around the corner called Ricus, which is was just opened by the women who own Wyoming, the butcher shop in Wyoming.
Okay.
So...
Yeah.
A lot of stuff going on in Covington right now. So I feel like we should be semi-optimistic this year. We had a rough end of the last year with restaurants closing, but I feel like I know the restaurant business is precarious. I understand there's a lot of challenges they're facing. The best thing you can do is go out there and eat out as much as you can, even if it's just a couple small bites, appetizers at the bar, you know.
And don't forget about our Northern Kentucky restaurants. Burl and I tend to talk about a lot of things that are downtown, just because that's where we are. Like, we're working here. But with the bridge closure and the fire and everything, we cannot forget about supporting our neighbors just across the river and going to those restaurants and helping them out.
Yes, and that has been hurting them. So if you I've gotten over there pretty easily on the weekends, I'll say, to restaurants in Newport, Covington, Bellevue, Dayton. But they could really use your support right now.
Suspect that nighttime is the problem because the bridge traffic at night is so difficult in rush hour that you just avoid it altogether.
Yeah, I understand that, but I'm just saying.
Or you forget, like myself and Burl has spoken about it on this podcast. If you forget, you just...
Yes.
Not fun.
yes, but definitely worth your while to go out there, even if you hit a little bit of traffic. It'd be a good thing to do for that restaurant community out there right now.
All right. Well, this is one of my favorite things that you write about every month. So thank you for doing that because you can know what's coming.
You're welcome.
All right. So let's bring on David. Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I am so excited to welcome the owner, chef, visionary of Wildweed, David Jackman.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Oh, so I'm going to let Keith take the lead on a lot of the conversation because he's the expert, but we are super glad to welcome you at the perfect timing. We like to do that here on the podcast. Congratulations on your James Beard nomination.
Thank you. Yeah, it was pretty exciting. We had pretty much all but believed that it wouldn't happen this year with everything that we've, you know, done. We're still only 6 months old, so it was a bit of a shock.
Where were you when you heard the news?
I was on the phone doing an interview, believe it or not, for something else, and my phone just started blowing up. Our general manager, Justin Pater, was the first person to message me. He was like waiting for it to drop at 10 a.m. and he was the one who actually congratulated me first, and then all of a sudden, you know, I had about 30 or 40 people within half an hour.
Did you get off the phone right away, or did you keep doing the interview?
No, I let the phone do its thing, and then probably halfway through the day, I had to turn it off because it was distracting me too much.
Why? Did you have something to do at night? Did you have to go in and cook and run a restaurant?
Maybe running the restaurant, maybe all the mise en place we needed for the day, and getting the team where they needed to be. So yeah, it's. It's a crazy restaurant. It has a lot of moving parts, and it definitely takes a lot from you. So when your phone starts blowing up, they're like, get off your phone, you know?
It's a huge moment. And, you know, as I texted you myself, well-deserved. And what does it mean to you to get this, you know, first year open? It's not even for best new restaurant. It's for best chef in the region, which also includes Chicago, Indianapolis, Columbus,
Detroit. Yeah. It's huge. It's, you know, it's, I definitely know a lot of the restaurants on that list. I've eaten at some of them, and it means a lot. We're a restaurant that focuses on our region. So we're not just necessarily driven by ego, we're driven by our community. And so a large part of what we do, is specializing on about our region, and to be recognized within our region means a lot. I grew up in Canada. So going to, being able to even say James Beard is something that you'd never think that you would get, because, you know, it wasn't even in your market when I grew up, and, you know, likely won't ever. It was really special. Yeah.
And an uptick in reservations after that announcement went out, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I'd say about 25%.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is pretty great. You know, I think what they provide for restaurants, especially around this time of year when they can be pretty slow, it can be pretty special.
Okay. And you're no stranger to national recognition. Bon Appetit named you one of the most exciting new openings of 2024. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like they worded it interestingly, but it was essentially their most anticipated list of the summer. Yeah. Yeah.
And then Esquire this year, was it top 50 new restaurants?
It was 35 best new restaurants in America. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. a weird number. I don't know where the 35 came from.
This is like a journalism thing.
Yeah.
It does always have to be an odd number.
Oh, really?
Like even numbers don't work for lists. I don't know why that is.
All right. Good to know. that one brought a lot of excitement too. Especially for a magazine that, you know, all across the country, you can buy one off the shelves, and that was pretty special. It was also really great. Honestly, the biggest part of Esquire was the people I got to meet. They throw a party every year alongside their list, and I was in a room full of some of the great chefs in the country. You know, Danielle Ballou, Eric Repair. There's a photo on their on their Instagram of me with my arms around Jean-Georges and joking around.
Wow.
And it was pretty special. I didn't meet them personally, but Iggy Pop and Martha Stewart were at the party. It was quite the ordeal.
I would like to be in proximity to Martha Stewart, I'm just saying.
I didn't know they did a party like
that.
Yeah,
it was quite wild. It was at 425 Park, Jean-Georges and Jonathan Benno's new restaurant. They were celebrating their 1 year in conjunction with it. And so the party was pretty wild in the lobby, you know, snacks everywhere. If you went upstairs, you can have small plates. But at a certain point, it just devolved into a wild party, open bar, all the things. But the really great part was a number of people that were on that list, and they were also included in James Beard's nominations this year as well. We all got to, you know, really connect and talk about what makes each of our restaurants special. There was a, you know, Yia Vang based in Minneapolis, who has restaurant Vinay, who celebrates Hmong cuisine. Johnny Curiel, who used to work in the city and with the Crown Republic Group. He's got a Michelin star at Alma Fondafina now in Denver, and he was there and meeting the couple from Johnny and Sarah from Atoma in Seattle. All these people that, you know, it really started the beginning of a friendship friendships within the country that I never thought I would have so easily. And so when the nominations came around for James Beard, it was also very exciting because I got to text, you know, a number of my new friends and just start sending them congratulations as well. So
what do you think's happened in the past 5 or so years in Cincinnati? There's been a big shift in the kind of attention we're getting from national media. We're getting a lot more Beard nominations. What changed in the past 5 years, do you think?
I honestly don't know. I think a large part of it was, you know, we see Mike Stankovich getting a number of recognitions for both Mid-City and Longfellow throughout the past few years. I think people in this market also come from other markets that maybe had a spotlight on them. And then chefs do come and start building things here. And because they've kind of brought their skill sets here, the national media is also focusing on it. I think also, you know, there's a huge influx in people focusing on areas in the Midwest rather than, you know, the same places in New York and Los Angeles. And, you know, like in a city like this, you can get away with doing something really special without the overhead that, you know, you might have to in New York or San Francisco or a larger city. So I think that's a huge part of maybe the attention is that we have exciting things happening in our community.
Yeah. Sherry and I were talking earlier about, you know, whether Cincinnati could become something like the next Nashville or something like that.
Let's avoid the party buses.
Well, you've worked there. So let's talk a little bit about your origin story. Because you have been in Nashville, so you're an expert on answering that question. So we're going to come back to the question.
Okay.
But tell us.
Fair enough.
So you said you grew up in Canada. How did you get here?
It's a bit of a roundabout way. I mean, I've spent time in other markets in the country. I spent some time in Nashville back in 2014, I believe, 2015. I was at Catbird with Trevor Moran, and I hosted him in Vancouver at a restaurant that I had ran, did a guest chef series in conjunction with, you know, the tourism board in Vancouver. And as we kind of developed our relationship even further, he wanted me to help open Locust. I didn't know how it was going to happen. I went down to visit him, and that's when I met my now wife, Lydia. And we were on a trip. She made me a cheeseburger at Dino's, the quintessential dive bar in Nashville. And she was telling me that she was moving to Cincinnati for a job. She was going to start cooking at a place called Please that's no longer around. And I was like, okay, well, I'll come visit eventually, you know, maybe. And she's like, yeah, you're full of it. But I did. And, you know, I had already fallen in love with her, and I definitely fell in love with the city as soon as I came here. I you know, it felt very like home. For me, a city like this is, it's the other edge of the Midwest, I always say, because I mean, I grew up in Winnipeg, where, you know, north of North Dakota. And then here we're kind of just on the cusp of, you know, the South, so to speak, with the Kentucky border. And so, you know, there's a lot of similarities and similar sensibilities to my home. You know, like we both have abandoned subway systems. We both have rivers that run through them. We're both blue collar working class cities that really support their sports teams. And it goes down to the point where, you know, if you talk to someone in Winnipeg and you're like, oh, nice to meet you. Yeah. You know, it starts with where'd you go to high school? You know, same as here. So,
sounds familiar.
So it felt really comfortable when I got here. But it was beautiful, and I had fallen in love with it, and I was ready for a new challenge. And so, of course, I'd worked in some really great markets before that, Vancouver, Toronto. I grew up in Winnipeg cooking there, spent some time in Chicago a little bit, the Bay Area, both in Napa, Sonoma, and also in San Francisco, and then Nashville. But it was like, okay, well, I'm ready for a new challenge where I can kind of step back and take a breath and see what I really want to do with this.
So you came here to work at Pearl Star, right?
No, I actually came here and ended up working at Please first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then...
Which makes sense. Please is just before Wildweed.
Yeah.
Like it was the most inventive. People like just loved Please. It was small and just something extraordinary.
Yeah.
And it was really hurt by COVID.
Yeah. So you spent some time at Pearl Star. And then after that is when the Wildweed pop-ups started. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I helped open Pearl Star, and we were navigating opening Royce, both now no longer existing. And I'd kind of hit a point where right before joining their team where I was, you know, trying to open something already, and it kind of fell flat. And, you know, I had investors walk out the door, and, you know, kind of was left to hold bags, lost a lot of money. And I had a, you know, 2-month-old and a rent that I needed to pay. And so I joined the team, and I said I'd give it 6 months to see where it went. I met a lot of great people, but ultimately, you know, the challenges that restaurant provided for me on a personal level didn't really work. You know, I was working long hours. It was really stressful. The expectations were unrealistic in ways that, you know, I couldn't give the tools to my team to be the best versions of themselves because I wasn't given the tools either. So Wildweed was really a response to that. We started doing pop-ups immediately. That was kind of my exit strategy for Pearl Star. I had built, you know, a big wooden table to make pasta on and, you know, said, let's give it one more go. And if not, we're going to need to do something else because, you know, the style of restaurant and the style of businesses that I've been in up to this point may not kind of support having a daughter and a family. So we really started it with the intention of how do we build something that's going to create equity in every person's life that comes in. It's a hard restaurant still, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. We all work very long hours, but it's, you know, we get what we put in, I feel. And so Wildweed started as a pop-up. We did 250 pop-ups around North America. Around America, we went from Vermont to Tennessee.
I didn't know that you were traveling around doing.
Yeah, we were doing just little one-offs. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. We did a little tour, kind of in between some of the residencies we had mm-hmm. done. So we had started at Rooted in Findlay, which now is Moxie, and then after that closed, we kept going a couple more weeks, and then we moved to Mighty Good. Then once they closed, we just moved in for a few months. And then, after that, we kind of we didn't know what we were going to do while we were waiting for the next, you know, situation and for the restaurant to open. Cause by then we had signed the lease. We had been, you know, finding investors, finding opportunities to, you know, build our brand and our name. So we decided we'd take it on the road. It didn't really make money. It was more about, you know, keeping us afloat
and doing things.
It also worked because I've heard about you from Christian Schlottman, who runs the Film Commission.
Yeah.
And she's like, I happened to call, I was interviewing her for something, and she's like, I'm in Lexington and I had the most amazing dinner last night. And she's like, we have to go there. And I was like, I have not heard of this. I immediately asked Keith because I get to sit next to him every day. But she just was raving about it and immediately wanted to come back. And I don't think she realized at that point it was like a pop-up. But then I was like, okay, it's opening now. But it was interesting. But I heard about it.
That one was interesting. That was at Darling Wine Bar, which is a little cute wine bar that does not have a kitchen. So you know, what was special about what we did was, you know, we didn't always necessarily have a kitchen. We did an event at 1215 Wine Bar, for instance, here in Cincinnati. And you know, they don't have a kitchen either. We completely took over their coffee station and turned it into a kitchen. We had a display shelf working like a pastry kitchen. One of the things that I don't tell people a lot is that I used to run a private events and catering company in Vancouver. It was for someone who used to run a Marco Pure White restaurant. He was a pretty big deal. It was kind of known at the time as one of the top restaurants in Vancouver. It was in, you know, Rosewood Hotel, Georgia, and it was called Hawksworth Restaurant. And so as we were kind of transitioning and doing private events, they had a sous chef running it for the most part. At one point, believe it or not, David Silber was actually doing that position, the guy who got known for Noma's Guide to Fermentation. But I was the first person they hired to actually run the program that wasn't a sous chef from outside. We turned it from a $1 million business to a $5 million business. And we did everything. You know, it was Le Creuset openings, Prada openings.
Wow. I didn't know anything about that chapter.
You know, we would take over, you know, a restaurant on the top of Whistler Blackcomb and, you know, drive everything in. We did 500 person dinners in hangars for Air Canada in Toronto. So we would fly all of our mise en place there. It was a pretty special.
See, you're not kidding because you're talking about like doing this. What I'm hearing is that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
To bring all the food, if you have a dinner party from the kitchen into the dining room,
is
a lot of work. So like to bring it to a whole nother city seems like that is a lot of dedication.
Yeah.
And going back to the pop-ups, for those who don't know, were you focused primarily on pastas at every pop-up or were you doing other dishes as well?
It started as pastas. We started I mean, we started it as Wildweed 3 years ago, but we did a precursor to that that kind of helped just kind of define what we were going to do the second time around. And that was called Sunday Sauce at Oakley Wines. And when we were at Oakley Wines, it was always three pastas, four pastas. I didn't want to step on their business too much. So, we didn't do it much more than that. But as we kind of grew, it's, you know, we wanted to do snacks. We had done a pop-up with ice cream for a little while out of the takeaway just next to Ziegler Park called Ziggy Whip. And it was – so frozen desserts kind of got thrown in there. But really it's just, you know, how do we create fun dishes that are fun to eat?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, your approach to pasta is really interesting. Could you describe that?
Yeah. I mean, the quick answer is non-traditional, but really, pasta is not a start or finish. We talk about things like traditional to when. It's a time and place. So, you know, I know that, you know, in all the regions in Italy, they're going to say, oh, this is always how it's been done. But, you know, due to the changes in manufacturing, different products, different farmers growing different things, it hasn't always been the same variety and the same thing. We're just celebrating a snapshot in time and place now versus what someone did there. And, you know, the noodle road didn't start in Italy. It started in China. So I don't feel the necessary kind of connection to use noodles as an Italian thing. So for me, it's more, you know, I've never been to Italy. I've never, I've worked in Italian restaurants in Canada. But I'd never, you know, I know all the ingredients that come from there. I've read, you know, the slow food Bible of ingredients that they get. And I've tried to grow many of them, but for me, it was, what is our time and place? Pasta is a canvas. We just use that to kind of celebrate what, we can get locally, what we can get from farmers, what we can use to keep dollars in our community.
And you've really harnessed, the ingredients of the Midwest. I know that one of the great things about your restaurant is your love of foraging really brings something to the table there. Tell me a little bit about, I know that you were growing the tomatoes you were using for your tomato salad. You were growing in your backyard. You forage for pawpaws to make this pawpaw, I call the pawpaw chipwich ice cream sandwich. It's fantastic. But in the winter months, what are you working with right now?
I think it's for when... It's a good question. Winter for me is, everyone sees it. It's easy to be a chef in summer. You take something, you put it on a plate and it's delicious, right? Winter, you need to coax out the beauty and the ingredients more. It's based on technique. It's based on how do you find the brightness of an ingredient and celebrate it? Right now, one of the things that we're really celebrating is, you know, this Savoy spinach that we get. It has more frills to it. It has more texture. It has more flavor. We just put on a salad with that. And, you know, every farmer's like, yeah, I got spinach. And they're thinking like, okay, everyone's going to wilt it and do this, whatever. For us, it was, how do we create a dish around this spinach? And so we have like an avocado and dill emulsion on the bottom, and all these leaves are layered the same way upside down. And we use it to catch the last of the winter citrus. We're not dogmatic in the fact that we, you know, only buy from here. We do buy really specialty ingredients from around the country, but for the most part, it's, you know, as much as we can, we try to keep our dollars in our community. But we built really strong relationships with people like Pearson Ranch in California, so we get some beautiful kumquats from them. And we do, you know, like a little spinach salad with avocado and a number of different citrus that we get that are specialty as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I love talking about food.
Another ingredient, for instance, at the start of our tasting menu, we coax the flavors out of radishes. Radishes is something that's often a little more humble. So how do we find excitement in something like a radish? One of the first bites is a little radish roll that's shaved winter radishes stuffed with Japanese pickles, a little white miso and fig leaf dressing. So fig leaves from the summer. Preservation is a huge part of how we kind of pull things out of another season and bring them into this one.
Yeah. And I want to talk more about your tasting tasting counter. What I love about it is that you're taking, is it always seven ingredients? Does it vary?
Yeah. Yeah. It's always seven ingredients, but it's never seven plates.
Yeah. So. And it'll literally say you'll get at the end of your meal, you'll get a little menu of what you've eaten. And it'll just say when you walk in, it'll just say radish.
Absolutely.
And you don't know what you're getting. You know, it's just going to be your interpretation of a radish, the way you, as you said, coax those flavors out. It's a really interesting, way about going about it. And I can't recommend it enough. If you haven't done the chef's counter there, the tasting counter, please do. How is that being received? Is it?
It's been great. We're only busier and busier every day at the counter. We went from at the early periods, we'd have a Tuesday to Thursday that was slow, and then Friday, Saturday, we'd be pretty full. But now I think people have realized that Tuesday to Thursday is the opportunity where they're not going to get rushed as much or mm-hmm. not necessarily rushed, but where it won't be as wild in the restaurant. And if they want to have it a little quieter of an experience at the chef's counter, they're going to be able to. By no means are we empty. It's been really well received. And the way we say it is, the reason we give that card at the start with seven ingredients on it, I always describe it as it's an opportunity to see where you are in your meal, but not necessarily where you're going. And for that, that's so we can hold the suspense and the surprise, because part of the fun of doing an elongated tasting menu, which there isn't really many opportunities to do in the city, is that, you're going to try something that you haven't tried before. And so throwing people down that rabbit hole and then catching them and making sure that they feel comfortable mm-hmm. by the end and excited and want to do it again is the point.
And the way that those ingredients show up in each dish can be kind of surprising sometimes.
Absolutely.
A lemon verbena.
Yeah, lemon verbena was mostly just a secondary sauce on a halibut dish, or squash on our current halibut set is like a crispy twill, and we have a loin of halibut that's wrapped with a mousseline and then ribbons of squash. And that goes into a little beautiful thing that gets basted in brown butter and maple vinegar with a chestnut cream and shaved chestnuts and gooseberries and pickled elderflowers from the spring. And so squash is really not the focus, but it's more about the idea of squash being, well, the squash is there, but it's more about the squash being a secondary role and the flavors playing off of that squash.
Yeah. And, one other thing I should mention is that one of the best things I ate last year was your Dungeness crab bisque, which was mm-hmm. part of that tasting menu.
Yeah.
Which that kind of shows that you're
that
not just
still there.
It's still there.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, everybody go try this. It's fantastic. But in offering that dish, what you're taking your past experiences and bringing those to the table too, your time on the West Coast working as a chef.
Absolutely. Yeah. The bowl was actually made by a Vancouver ceramicist too. Mm-hmm. It's a little bowl of kind of like a mock congee, but instead of rice, we use gnocchi mushrooms, and we fold in ramp butter and the Dungeness crab meat and a little crab stock, and we layer the leg meat over top, and then we make a sauce that's like a bisque that gets foamed. It has all the roe and the fat kind of whipped into it, and it's really, really well balanced dish. And as you dig in, you just get spoonfuls of what feels like crab. And that dish was probably a starting point to how I discovered my style of cooking and how I wanted to cook. And so for a large part of why we have it on the menu is I want to take something from, we don't reinvent the wheel every day. It wouldn't be as exciting. Sometimes we bring something back, or sometimes we create something new. But this one really tests the time because it really helped me define my cuisine.
Okay. Can you describe? I'm sitting here like listening to an artist talk, and everyone has like their own process. Do these things, recipes just come to you?
Sometimes,
or do you have to spend a lot of time like thinking about it? Because you're really busy all the time.
Yeah.
How do these appear
I think the process is, it's different for different dishes. Sometimes it's, they're usually an evolution. You start somewhere and you end somewhere else. For instance, that halibut didn't have chestnut on it at all a couple months ago, but it was more based around squash and a couple things. that crab, you know, it was a large bowl at one point, which I think many people would be very grateful for it still. But, you know, it's now this thing that you kind of discover and dig into. I oftentimes, yeah, if I can't sleep at night, that's where an idea comes. Sometimes when an ingredient comes into season, you're like, oh, I've got an idea. It just snaps and then a dish will become, you know, present right away. And sometimes it's, you know, let's try this and let's see where it goes. You know, for instance, the tortelli that we have on the menu, I had a pretty good idea because we had done some similar things with our pop-up. We have a dish that has striped gochugaru chilies and yellow strips of egg dough layered back and forth. It's like a striped pasta that's pretty lovely. And we do a smoked shrimp stock. The smoked part of the shrimp was actually an addition later that was like someone had suggested on the team. A little tossed shrimp in there. And so it kind of resembled a Vietnamese noodle bowl with a chicken sausage on the inside of the tortelli. And we make a stock with all the smoked shrimp and we finish it with like a fish sauce caramel almost that has like a nice vinegar from Keep Well Vinegars out of Pennsylvania. And a bunch of different herbs, you know, coriander, lemon balm. And it changes a little bit depending on what's available and what farms have and what we can source. But
were you like this from a young age? Did you know you wanted – when you were growing up, did you know that you wanted to do this?
No. I started cooking because I needed a job as – you know, it was more of a means to an end. It was, you know, I can afford going out on the weekends and getting into trouble because I had a job and my, you know, fellow teenagers didn't. So but as it kind of evolved – you know, as you got good at it, you realize, oh, well, this is something I'm going to probably want to do for a long time. I had a cook ask the other day, you know, how do you sustain this? You know, I'm 22 years deep in cooking and it's a long day, you know, every day is a long day. And how do you sustain it? And, you know, part of it is having healthy routines and that, but she's like, why do you still do it? After so many years, I said, it provides so many opportunities for you to connect with so many people. That is the root of, you know, what food is in our culture. Sometimes we forget that, you know, on our everyday, it's just a sandwich. It's just this or that, but food is a way for everyone to connect. Everyone eats. Everyone has a story of where they come from and everyone's going somewhere else. So, you know, it's provided me to meet a lot of incredible people that I never thought I would meet. You know, I used to have regulars like Elvis Costello in Vancouver was one of the cool ones that, yeah, weekly I was the sous chef at a restaurant and I'd go to his table and talk to him and Diana. And it was pretty, pretty cool. Or for instance, you know, I had U2 visit my restaurant probably about 7 times within a month. And like Edge would sit at the bar, they'd have their security, but it was right next to the kitchen. And so he'd be asking me cooking tips and this and that. So that, you know, like there's these, you know, and not just famous people, like I've met some of my closest friends through cooking and through this industry. And those relationships have blossomed, you know, to the point where, you know, no matter where I go, I know I'm going to find someone I know or something I know that I can connect with someone with.
Any celebrity sightings at Wildweed so far?
we had an actor at the chef's counter. Oh, what's his name? I forget. He's been in a few cool things and I didn't recognize him, but other people did. No, not really.
Well, not Cincinnati's a little short on celebrities. unless we get Sundance.
Yeah.
do you know when like there's food writers in like –
sometimes.
Or the beginning, like Keith, but like the national food writers that have, or the James Beard judges, you know, when they're in the restaurant?
We miss some of them. we catch some of them. Okay. I'm like, how much do I tell you here?
Oh, I see. Yeah. Or you can keep some writer. Secrets if you want.
No, we screen for them. Yeah, we do, but we don't always catch them. For us, we actually have a list of food media that are not necessarily attached to the James Beard Awards, but James Beard also lists their voting body. So we screen for both of those lists through our reservations every day. I don't know if there's any other restaurants in the city that do that, but my wife, Lydia, who's part of the large part of, you know, making this happen. She does a lot of the behind the scenes things that I'm too busy to do, but she does guest relations as her main focus in the restaurant. She'll still do, you know, kitchen stuff. She'll still be running around for ingredients just like I am. But every day she starts her day going through reservations and making sure people are taken care of at the counter. We know allergies in advance. We've taken care of dietary restrictions, special requests, things like that. And then, you know, she's the one who prints out all of our tickets for our chef's counter, because we print them out. It's not a kitchen printer. We actually print them out as a full list, and then we cross them off as we go through the night. And, you know, we do a deep dive into the guests that we're talking to. That way, if there's chances to connect with them, we can connect on what they do. But yeah, so we screen.
But that's the level of attention to detail that then the James Beard, the judges were in there at some point.
Yeah.
And I know the answer to this, but just so for people who don't, where does the name Wildweed come from?
Yeah, it was kind of like, you know, came out of nowhere in the same way that, you know, what we did is. So it's rooted in, it started as a very little thing, a little crack in the sidewalk, and it built into what it is now. You know, I moved here with a backpack and t-shirts 6 years ago, so it literally grew from nothing. You know, it grew from ideas and hard work.
And another thing I like that you've done is you've collaborated with local artists to do one of the murals on the wall, I believe, and some of your menus.
Two murals. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we have Maxwell Redder, who did a 18x4 foot painting across our kitchen, across our main dining room. And it's absolutely stunning. They're all real mushrooms. Yeah. The colors have been changed a little bit, but it's pretty vibrant and definitely fits that Alice in Wonderland thought, you know, being thrown down the rabbit hole. On the exterior, we also had Blake Lipper do a beautiful kind of entranceway mural. And then we have Drew Chrisman and John Flannery. So Drew Chrisman, who great artist on his own and also does stuff, has worked in Mid-City and Longfellow for a long time. He drew all the covers for our menus that we give at the chef's counter, and John Flannery prints them. And that was kind of a continuation of things we had done with our pop-ups, because they would do all the posters for anything that we were doing big. We got them printed professionally by them. So
we do like, we're running a little bit short on time, but we do like to ask, like, what do you do outside of cooking? I don't know if you have time though. I am listening.
These days there's not much time. Most of my time outside the restaurant goes to my daughter first. Because of the long hours, don't see her as much as I'd like to. So ultimately we do that. I like eating as well. So, you know, every Sunday we, as a family, try to find somewhere new in the city where we haven't been and we try it out. That is just our Sunday lunch tradition. So as we're off, we go, you know, I've sent you, Keith, a couple recommendations.
He recommended an Uzbek restaurant.
Restaurant and also a dim sum restaurant. Dim sum is
the
definitely
dim sum
not,
I've not been to yet, but the Uzbek restaurant. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So good.
Pretty cool experience too. Nice comfy chairs.
What's the name of it?
It was called, it's over in Fairfield.
Yeah.
It's, I'm so bad with names.
The Plove.
Yes. Yeah.
Check it out if you haven't been.
You have to now.
Yeah. Yes. But yeah, I like talking to David because he always has really good restaurant recommendations, usually places that have been off my radar. So I appreciate that.
We all in the newsroom go to Keith.
Yeah. You're welcome.
David's the brains behind the whole operation.
You're welcome.
I got to admit it now. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite that you've been to?
Recently? Yeah. Duck Beijing House. Duck Beijing House. They have a New York dim sum or Peking duck chef. They do incredible Peking duck, and then, you know, a really great dim sum on the weekends. They were also known as Casual Chinese Gourmet or something. They have a location in Kentucky and same owner. And he's like, this isn't working where we are, so we're going to actually bring in a chef and do something. And what they've grown into is spectacular. And everyone I've gone with who've lived, you know, on the West Coast or something, they're like, this is what I missed. in the city. This is what I missed. So, having lived in Vancouver for 8.5 years, I missed dim sum on a Sunday morning. That's definitely one of the ones. Yeah.
And one thing I want to bring up is that you have been, after doing so many pop-ups, you're now hosting pop-ups at Wild Weed. You just had one recently with another Nashville chef. Can you tell us a little bit more about those?
Yeah. So the one in Nashville was really special because the owner who opened Bad Idea and I, through COVID, catered a wine class. I catered a wine class for him every week. And so seeing his business open and ours open, we kind of got to compare notes and do these things. And now we have, you know, he invited his chef Colby, who used to be the right hand man for Sean Brock. Great skill set, oh, wow. Really, really cool technique. And so we were able to bring, you know, excitement to our team and provide our team some things to see. And that's the whole idea of these dinners and pop-ups. It's, you know, a series of dinners where we connect our team and our guests with chefs from other cities. And so they can experience it without having to travel. Coming up, we have, you know, Ye Vang from Minneapolis. He has Vinai, incredible restaurant. Yeah. And then we have, following that, we have Gus Steffenhofer Branson from Published on Main in Vancouver. He's got a Michelin star, but really he forages just like us. We both come from Winnipeg, and we've both been cooking for years together and sharing stories and foraging sometimes together. Following that, we'll be also bringing Johnny Curiel in May to do one as well. You know, he spent a little time here, mm-hmm. and he feels like he has a little more to give to the city. So he's excited to bring back what he's been working on and share it with the city.
Okay. And anyone who wants to attend, are these on the website?
They're not quite live, but we will announce them as they go live.
You will?
Absolutely.
Okay. Great.
So let's go back to something that we were talking about earlier. Why is Cincinnati so special?
The people, the community. I've never been somewhere where the community has supported ideas as much as this city does. For me, being an outsider, you know, you can support, people will support their own usually when you go to a city, but people actually supported an idea that we were doing right from the start. You know, we started doing a pop-up at Oakley Wines, and it was, you know, it went from doing, you know, maybe 15 pastas in a day to, you know, 80 to 90 every day. And you're like, okay, well, you know, there's something here. And part of that was just, you know, the community continued to support. It wasn't just they're going to go one time. Yes, it's delicious, but no, I want to bring my friend next time. And it's the same way in the restaurant. You know, we'll have guests that have been coming for years now to our pop-ups. And every time they come, they're like, no, I need to introduce another friend. Mm. And so, you know, it's a community, and it's, you know, we all make this place better. It's not, you know, it's not New York. It's not San Francisco. You don't have every single thing on every corner. But what we do have, we try to celebrate and support, and it all lifts each other together up. So
that is a perfect note to end on, I think.
Yep.
Thank you so much for coming in. It's so much fun to hear about the food.
Yeah.
And like the intricate details of it.
Yeah. We obsess over it every day. It's the least we can do is talk about it just a little bit, you know.
Well, we appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. So I feel like there is a theme here, which is we all need to go out to eat more, like we talked about at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And everything that he talked about his food, I want to go eat now instead of doing bad things at my desk, like eating Subway or a taco from Taco Bell. I'm very bad about that. I really need to remember to go to these places and enjoy the experience and talking to people and like we do when we go out to eat.
Exactly. Yes.
So, all right. This is your reminder too. Try and get your Valentine's Day reservations. That is a very tough thing to do right now because I tried to do it yesterday.
Oh, so, did you really?
Yeah. Don't wait till the last minute, you guys. Okay. In apparently 2 weeks is the last minute.
Yeah.
Well, I'll have to navigate that. But anyway, this is your reminder. Just if you want to do that, look now.
Good public service message there.
Yes.
Appreciated. Yes.
All right. So we're going to continue our theme because we first heard about a very Cincinnati food item in the Inquirer, spotted by sharp-eyed reporters here on Kroger's website at least 6 months ago, and it has come to fruition. I've tried it, and Keith has actually reviewed it, which is a new flavor of Grater's Skyline Chili.
And it is so good.
That is not the sentence we thought we were going to say, but here we are.
It really is. The thing that we have to remember here is this is Grater's making this ice cream. Grater's never messes up. They are one of the most famous ice cream makers in the country. They are not going to risk their reputation to put something out there that tastes terrible or gross as so many people think it's going to be. And if you think about it, too, Cincinnati chili, the spice profile lends itself perfectly to ice cream. You've got nutmeg, you've got cinnamon, you've got clove, and those are the flavors that you're really tasting with this. I compared it to one of our reporters, Grace Tucker, described it as tasting like a chai latte, which I totally agree with. Some people say it tastes like cinnamon ice cream, but it really works. And there is some chili pepper in there, too, so you do get a little bit of that chili flavor. There are oyster crackers that are crunched into the ice cream.
So think about, instead of like the chocolate chips that Grater's is so famous for, it has chunks of oysters crackers in it.
But I have a recommendation, a pro tip: order extra oyster crackers, or buy extra oyster crackers if you're going to be eating this at home, because what you want to do is just put a sprinkle of them on top of the ice cream and then mash it in, because it adds to that saltiness and crunchiness. It really accentuates the flavor there.
There is so much Skyline consumed in the Coolidge household. We do have a teenage boy that we just have bags of crackers from the takeout. Like, I keep them in like a glass jar, and they're just something we grab to snack on. But this is an excellent pro tip, because I was saying that I needed a little bit more of the salty oyster cracker earlier when he and I were talking about it. And this would help that.
Yeah. And if you really want to go full Skyline, get a peppermint patty and top it with that.
Oh my gosh, that's not what you want to do there. I haven't tried it, putting hot sauce on it.
I put hot sauce on it, and I loved it. It really worked.
I think I'm going to have to draw the line there, even though I like hot sauce on a lot of stuff, but I don't know.
Give it a shot. Just go light on it.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, I feel like you guys have already tried it. It's sold out a lot of places. They seem to be restocking it very quickly, though. And like, it's the kind of thing where if the closest Kroger to you doesn't have it, then the next one does.
Yeah. And I bet there's a lot of people out there looking for it, going place to place at this point.
It is a true phenomenon. And I myself loved it. It was a happy surprise.
Yeah. I really encourage you to try it. I feel like I was just saying it could be like Grater's version of the McRib, where it'll go away and then it's going to come back in a year. And
do you think they'll be pressured into keeping it all the time? It is Cincinnati.
I would love it if they would keep it all the time. I would order it all the time, but we'll see how it goes.
All right. Well, you'll read all about that at Cincinnati.com. I promise. Like, we've written a lot about it, and we will keep doing that.
Yes.
That's what we do
here.
We're
on it.
All right. Keith, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's been fun.
This was very fun. And we have a very special guest next week. So tune in again. I appreciate everyone who's listening. And we're going to look ahead next week.
All right.